Hi, Brent Clough here, welcoming you to 360 Documentaries. And along with the rest of ABC Radio National this week, we're turning our gaze to China. Today we're replaying Reading the News from China, a provocative program made 2 years ago in the lead up to the Beijing Olympics. Once closed to the West, China is opening up in unprecedented ways. Our ideas on what makes modern China tick can come from a whole range of media sources, from the tightly controlled state-run radio and TV to millions of blogs, and an increasingly obsessed Western media. While internet giants like Google are finding it hard to grapple with the subtle complexities of Chinese censorship, there are plenty of journalists and bloggers who are desperate to tell the Chinese story. In today's feature, you'll meet James West, a journalist whose book Beijing Blur is based on his experiences working for state-run radio in China. Stephanie Hemelrick-Donald, an academic who's worked extensively in China, and writer Nicholas Jose. Here's Reading the News from China, Blogs, Bribes, Booms, and Post-Punk Beijing.
From China Radio International in Beijing, this is Real Time China.
God, first day at China Radio International. Well, first thing to say was I was hungover. I rocked up at this building in the middle of nowhere because Babaoshan is really a suburban backwater. And there's PLA officers, People Liberation Army officers, guarding this thing with a concertinaed gate, which is very popular in Beijing. And they would press a button and the concertinaed gate would kind of, you know, chug out, and I would be sort of let in, and this very mechanical arm would come out to see my pass.
Coming up on today's program, Following the News, we're going to be telling you about life in China. That's our special Sunday feature, so stick around for that.
And then I walked in and there's this weird dry fountain. It's not on and it doesn't have water in it, but it's got these cellophane fluorescent lights shining out of it. So it was kitsch and authoritarian at the same time.
Today, punk rock is Beijing chic.
Morning from China Radio International. I'm Yan Yinan, and welcome to Morning Edition of China Drive.
And I'm Mark Ripchuk. Today is the day to give it all away.
There are two Chinas, and sometimes they get confused. There's China, the country, and then there's Chinese culture, which is a much more porous, permeable, changeable thing, which is what Chinese people carry around with them. And that's not at all the same as the nation-state of China.
There's just something that's sort of like energy or a buzz, I think, around a little bit as well.
If you take buzz, what makes the Olympics sound special? What do you think?
Angry Chinese blogger, blog-city.com. So, who am I? This is a tricky question to answer, as I'm not always entirely sure who I am from one moment to the next.
CRI News, I'm Wen Jie. The first session of the 11th National Committee of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, the country's top political advisory body, will open on Monday afternoon and last 11 days.
Most Chinese people have thoroughly internalized where the boundary lines are, and they know when not to cross them. That gives rise to all sorts of oblique and coded ways of saying things.
Why am I blogging? I have seen things that most people never get to see, from a perspective that most people do not realize exists. Naturally, I feel a need to tell people about it. China can't be changed overnight, and it certainly can't be changed by a few bloggers. So, I'm not even going to try to change it, only to write about it.
A lot of people are not very political. It's the politics of staying abreast of, you know, your economic situation is sometimes a lot more important than, or at least it might be to certain people, than the politics of do we want to have a Western democracy or a Chinese democracy or a this or a that. So quite often people will not talk to you about politics because they just won't, because they're just not thinking about that right now.
Somebody showed me the desk and who my colleagues were, a bit of a tour of the building, a login. That was it. Sit down, start polishing English.
From China Radio International in Beijing, this is Real Time China.
Polishing means getting the script and working out how to make it better English. And quite often that was very, very hard because we were polishing the entire 24 hours of English language programming. I constantly thought things were missing in that, and they were. It was only the Chinese government's point of view.
This is World Insight from Beijing. I'm James Chow, and as always, we've got all you need to know on the Chinese perspective on the stories that count.
Angry Chinese blogger. The news and views about China that the big media can't or won't tell you.
There's a full 30 minutes coming up, so let's get started.
There are certain topics that you do not go near with a barge pole. And you usually know what those are. I mean, I'm kind of nervous to say the classic one on radio, actually, because I go to China a lot and I know how problematic it is. So I'm actually not going to say it.
To go behind that smiling face is another step or two. I'm talking to you the day after the Olympic torch has arrived in Beijing at Tiananmen Square, and there was a wonderful ceremony to welcome it. There were dancing girls, there were children, there were balloons. But none of the people of China were there. They were kept far, far away because they're concerned that there may be protests. Things may go wrong, and the Chinese authorities are acutely aware that Tiananmen Square is the big stage where protests have happened before, and that's the last thing they want at the moment.
The first session of the 11th National People's Congress and the first session of the 11th National Committee of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, set to open in Beijing on Wednesday and Monday respectively, will put to test Beijing's environment, traffic, public services, as well as the government's capacity in dealing with the emergencies. Hey, go, 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 na, 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 na.
Call the police.
We have Neighbourhood Watch here, but Neighbourhood Watch is nothing like the Neighbourhood Committee in a Chinese neighbourhood.
And they're pretty active, are they? Or they can be?
They're very active, and they're a mix of busybodies and representatives of the police and the state who are monitoring things. It's often a passive surveillance. It's just there, and it's not that people are always being dobbed in and things are always going wrong, but it's just there. And so if something happens, if you did go on one of these protests that we're talking about because you just couldn't hold back anymore, it would be the neighbourhood committee that would come and talk to you and say, well, what do you think you're doing? And they may have been your best friends for the last 10 years, but when they're activated, it's there.
How do you get on the committee?
Oh, you're usually a certain type of person who enjoys that sort of job. You've been around for a while. You've been loyal. You may have been rewarded in advance.
At first glance, the Chinese radio station resembled the ABC. Crusty bain-maries in the office canteen, geriatric PCs, endless middle management, and the daily disappearance of my chair were all friendly reminders of home. If I ever started freaking out about working for the communist propaganda machine, at least I could do so on the familiar bad espresso I'd grown to love at the ABC. The ABC was into its second year of a happy relationship with CRI, sharing know-how and advice on broadcast infrastructure around Asia, as well as human resources. But that's where the similarities stopped. Chinese state-run media was worlds away from the cuddlier concept of public broadcasting in Australia. On my first day, an intern quizzed me about the ABC. The Australian government gives the ABC money to run the corporation, I explained, but it has no say in how, really. It's independent. That's stupid, the intern interrupted. Huh? I stalled. Stupid, she went on. Why would the government give money to something that will only criticise them? Yes, I nodded. That is a good question. I fumbled my way through the distinction between public funding and government control, trying not to use the word democracy, like playing the board game Taboo. It's owned by the people, I concluded.
The obvious change is the rise of the blog, the rise of the internet, and although not everyone has access to a computer, many, 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 many millions of people do, so the blogosphere in China is really quite important. It's not always predictable. It's not necessarily a nice thing. You've got a lot of very heavy nationalist stuff happening. For instance, during the furore around the Olympic torch and the demonstrations in London and Paris, because I was president of a Chinese Studies Association, my name was around, and I was getting really quite unpleasant emails, some of them directly criticising me for being whatever. And there was a video, equivalent of a YouTube video, that was on Sinotube and had been sponsored in the anti-CNN campaign group, and they sent this video around. And it was really comparing the Dalai Lama and Bush to Nazis and doing that old fascist number, which was silly. It's always silly making facile comparisons, but it was also quite violent. The music was very aggressive, and the use of cutting and marching and the colours were very, very aggressive use of red and that kind of thing. So I found it a bit shocking, actually. Then, of course, I was sent one by the other side, which wasn't much better. That was showing sort of blood seeping across the map of China, and I think they might even have accused Hu Jintao of being a fascist. So it was the same thing. I would have to say that the other one was made actually in northern Scandinavia.
China is well on its way to becoming the biggest internet nation in the world.
Angry Chinese blogger, blog-city.com.
Websites that provide video programming or allow users to upload videos must have a permit and be either state-owned or state-controlled.
The other reason that I'm blogging, the main one has things then, is because I occasionally feel incredibly frustrated at the ignorance that is allowed to exist in the world.
I used to be a print journalist, but my articles were banned. Now I use the internet to address problems and to give a voice to ordinary people.
This is a secret office set up in an apartment in the center of Beijing. It's headquarters for Li Chindei and his friends. The blogger works day in, day out, writing about embezzlement, abuse of power, and corruption.
The internet is part of this brokering deal that the Chinese government has with its people, this fragile agreement that is continually evolving. We'll give you a bit of this if you shut up. You know, we'll give you a bit more money, we'll give you a bit more freedom of expression if you conform to some of these rules that we've got. And one of my friends at CRI said, you know, with the internet, we understand that there's certain rules and responsibilities with this, otherwise it might be taken away. And I think that's certainly understood in China amongst people my age, that we can use the internet, but we should use it in a way that the government sort of wants us to use it. And the world is very skewed on the internet. The world view of, that you get in China, of China, is incredibly skewed. Well, for example, on bulletin boards, which is a huge part of the Chinese internet, certain voices and certain opinions get expression where others don't. So nationalism is a huge thing on bulletin boards. You can criticize the Japanese government all you like until you're black and blue in the face. But as soon as you criticize anything to do with government policy, that is censored. So if you go online anywhere in China, the vision that you have of Chinese people is this rabid Japanese-hating group of people. And that's simply not the case if you take any kind of straw poll on the street.
Recently, video bloggers have also found themselves under scrutiny from the state. The web is full of China's new celebrities, but protests are shut out. This editor has to apply the rules.
We were surprised by the new directives. The government believes video blogs contain damaging information. As a blog service provider, we hope we won't be too limited, but we will follow the rules.
Access to this video has not been blocked yet. Li has published a story about the construction of luxury villas. He says this field of maize has been leveled and the land forcibly taken from the farmers.
Oh, hello. This is Robert. I'm in Beijing right now. My name is Laden Petong. I'm a Tibetan and the director of Students for a Free Tibet. I have a blog called BeijingWideOpen.org.
In the blogosphere, as they like to call it, there are kind of dissidents and radicals, but they all have the attention of the government. They're all being watched and, you know, famous cases of dissidents being arrested because of their blogging. And I interviewed this guy called Hao Wu, who I'm sure his blog led to his eventual arrest, 5 months imprisonment in China. Impossible to know how many bloggers are locked up in China.
What happened? No entries for a while. Are you okay? You didn't get punished for your latest story, did you?
There are things that will get closed down on purpose, like you still can't get the BBC. If you want to go and watch the BBC, well, you have to check into the Sheraton or something like that, because it's assumed if you're rich enough to sit in the Sheraton, you're not a political activist. They're probably right about that. You will get sites closed down and you're not quite sure how that happened. And of course, it could just be a mistake because you've got an enormous system and IT is not a perfect system anyways.
The biggest border in China, they call it the Great Firewall of China. And this thing is policed like no material border is policed in China. There's something like 300,000 internet police. And in fact, they've installed massive software operations to deal with this, provided by Western companies like Cisco, who provide a huge amount of technology for the Chinese government to monitor and censor their own people and to shut down at the IP level, as well as the level of information coming into China through the 9 gateways that the internet comes into China through. You're talking about a huge and multifaceted censorship program that is going on in this country that is effective.
There'll be lots of people who will know that something is not right. They won't know exactly what's happening, but they're so used to reading between the lines of the official media.
China a lot on this show, and the news is mainly along the lines of they've hacked into America, or they won't let anyone read Wikipedia or use Google. Well, this time it's different, sort of. The Chinese government have set up a website asking citizens to report corruption, but it received so many hits on its first day that it crashed under the weight of too many posts. Beijing Long, yeah,
these women are training to be Olympic hostesses, and they are practicing their best grins. Grins that their teachers say should show between 6 and 8 teeth. The hostesses say smiling for hours on end is hard work.
We have to wear high heels and stand with chopsticks in our mouths, books on our heads and paper between our knees. It's really tiring.
If you live in a traditional neighborhood in central Beijing, you may wake up one morning to find a large Chinese character in a circle painted in red or white on your home. It says Chai, which means demolish.
Nine of these women have been given the honor of handing out Olympic medals to the winning athletes. China's Olympic organizers say the presenters should measure between 168 and 174 centimeters in height, weigh no more than 55 kilos, and must be good looking.
These students all basically have a good face, relatively nice figure, and their body conditions and other aspects all fit the requirements of the service industry.
China's capital is about to get history's ultimate urban makeover. A mind.
The city is pouring concrete over memory. The pursuit of the future is evident in the net of cranes against the horizon, the nocturnal jackhammers, the restaurants entered along ramps, the solitary old guy who won't move from the now abandoned dust bowl. Not one thing is formed completely. One site to the east spans 10 city blocks and contains 19 cranes. The construction spills rubble, witches' hats delineate new temporary roads, and migrant workers, spades over shoulders, eat noodles on the curb. Another site contains 20 identical 28-story apartment blocks built along an artificial water causeway. The windows are all empty, waiting for inhabitants.
Photojournalist Chen Han, who has chronicled Beijing's traditional neighborhoods, is struggling to keep pace.
Sometimes I'll be riding past some place, and I'll say, "That's really nice. I'll have to come back and shoot it." By the time I get back there, I'm too late, and it's gone.
Beijing, we are ready.
Beijing, we are ready.
Beijing, we are ready.
Beijing.
The tension between old and new makes me anxious. But it speaks. Get up and work, work, work. China demands progress like no other country. It's doing what America did 50 years ago, but faster, with more ambition, and with more American entrepreneurialism than could ever fit behind an American picket fence.
China succeeds, Olympic Beijing will be a city unlike any other. But time is running out, and failure is not an option. Can China beat the clock?
There's an English language timeout, which has been running in Beijing for a little while, and it's incredibly helpful because it's a way of finding out what the listings are. Just, you know, it's time out, it's really useful in a big city. The Olympics edition has just been pulped. Who knows why? How incredibly stupid, actually. You know, you've got all these foreign tourists turning up and they're not going to find out where to go because you've just pulped time out.
Beijing, we are ready.
Beijing, we are ready.
Beijing, we are ready.
东兴电讯最动心.
It's amazing how quickly capitalism regenerated itself in the 1980s. There's a book that will be published soon by Li Jiazhuang called Socialism is Great, and it's her memoirs of being a worker. And a lot of what she's... And she's coming to Sydney, actually, in September. And a lot of what she's talking about are the people that she knew in the 1980s who were jumping into the sea, you know, leaving state-organised labour and starting up little businesses, or couldn't find jobs or had lost their jobs through the Cultural Revolution, or just lost them anyway in state-organised enterprises, and so had to set up little capitalist enterprises themselves, and how quickly they did it and how well they did and how inventive they were. And if you look at the stories from people, you know, there are other people, scholars, who've traced what happened to these people. And of course, it's like any, you know, it's capitalism. Some people do really well, other people do really badly or do really well and then lose it all. All those same stories are there.
新的手机是新机。
中国移动并不是手机。
妈，
是儿子，你到了吗？
还在巴黎，
不能回来过年了。
我理解。
That's who can't do business together. Chinese people and Indian people cannot do business together. Because Indians cannot live without a bargain, and Chinese people cannot give you a bargain. Their objective is to get every penny from you, and ours is to keep every penny. There's a really bad power struggle there.
One of my friends living in Beijing, this old China hand, said to me one day, James, Chinese people love money more than they love sex. And while on some level that's a flippant thing to say, I think Chinese people do really like money. Very ambitious, in a good way ambitious. I'm really reticent to criticise China and make generalisations, but from what I saw, people loved money. People loved getting ahead. People loved materialism. People loved buying shit. People loved improving their lives. People loved getting a really kick-ass car.
Tasted bitter defeat and the sweet success. You wanted all and you settled for nothing less. You've tried harder than the rest. You've become one of the best.
We struggle to give names for it. Is it capitalist? Is it materialistic? Is it devoid of spirituality? And yeah, I mean, potentially they're just as materialistic as we are. I think there's a Chinese dream, but I think if you ask any young Chinese person that's settled in Australia, any young first, second generation Australian, they'll go, their parents pushed me, their parents, you know, my parents wanted me to get an awesome job, and they're constantly asking me about how I'm going at work, and they're constantly asking me about money, and they're constantly asking me about whether I've gotten married yet, or, you know, about my girlfriend or boyfriend. And I think the Chinese dream has been around for a really long time, pre all this development stuff.
I went to this Chinese mall. Some of you may know it, Pacific Mall. That's the wrong place for an Indian guy to go. I saw this bag. I wanted to buy this bag. I go, how much? I go to the Chinese guy behind the counter. How much? He goes, $35. How about 30? And Chinese people will never tell you no. They'll tell you no, the longest no you've ever heard in your life. Like you just said, the most ridiculous thing they've ever heard in their life. I'll give you 30. No. No, I can't do $30. I sell you $30. Today you come, tomorrow I'll close down. I'm like, all right, well then give me a deal on the purse, man. I don't want to pay $35. Okay, one sec. I talk to my wife. One second. Thank you. Okay, you seem like nice guy. I'll give you best price, $34.50. I'm like, that's 50 cents, man. He goes, 50 cents, a lot of money. You save 50 cents here, then maybe you go somewhere else, you save another 50 cents. Then you have $1. Then you take your dollar, you go to the dollar store, you buy something else.
China now has a generation of kids growing up with both prosperity and exposure to Western pop culture.
Rebuilding the Rites of Statues. Brilliant band. Loved them. I discovered a bit of a punk scene there quite early on in my time in Beijing. And again, it was one of these things growing up through the cracks of China that, like the gay scene, that I never thought would exist. And this band was a three-piece originally from Chengdu in Sichuan province that really encapsulated the sound of Beijing for me. It was like being hit in the face with sand from the Gobi Desert or something. Like, this really thrashy, yelly punk band that sang about politics and sang about it in English. And I decided to follow this band a little bit around the place and profile them for the book. The radio plays the bad news in this morning. I'm born. I feel that the hand are touching my head. I'm born. I'm thinking of my future. Is it so difficult to be? I'm watching TV. Hang the police? Hang the police is one of their refrains. I mean, that's kind of radical for China, because all lyrics have to be passed through the Ministry of Culture. They were getting away with it. This band was getting away with singing in English because they were singing in English. And I think maybe the people at the Ministry of Culture, because it's punk and they're yelling in English, didn't really get it. They didn't publish their lyrics in the books. Well, they did, but it was scribbled. It was very hard to read. They also kind of got away with it, I think, as well, is because people at the Ministry of Culture are really concerned about domestic Chinese people, and the vast majority don't speak English enough to understand a Chinese punk band.
Comment from a reader. I'm a Chinese, just have poor English. Cannot understand everything very clear on your blog. But I like your style, I like your angry. Thank you for your angry.
Do 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 do. Oh, we're the Fuhua. We're having so much fun. We're the mascots for the Olympic Games in 2008 in Beijing. Do, 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 do. We used to be called the Friendlies, but then some smart American PR person said, actually, people might think friend lies if they see Friendlies. So now for the Fuhua. Do, do, do. Oh, yay, let's have fun. We're playing. We're getting ready.
There are many, many protests now of a grassroots kind, very often related to development issues. I was in China a couple of years ago when there was a major protest in a very remote town where grandmothers were protesting against toxic contamination of waterways from a factory there. Grandmothers in China can be pretty feisty, and they took to the streets with clubs, with sticks and stones. The army was sent in, hundreds of troops were sent in, and these grandmothers beat them off with sticks and stones. So it was quite an amazing event. The soldiers were kids, they were the grandchildren, and they're not really going to shoot the grandmothers.
Outside Beijing's main government complaints office, ordinary people seeking justice. Their cases are a profile of everyday human rights abuses across China. By law, they can come here to petition if they feel their cases haven't been properly heard. But nobody was listening.
The problem of income disparity is probably one of the biggest headaches the Chinese government has. They know that people who are sitting in little run-down towns, watching on television dramas in Shanghai and Beijing with people driving Mercs around and leading very sort of Western-style lives, not unlike in New York or elsewhere, and they're driving around their town on a cart being dragged by a donkey. But the problem has been that quite apart from the wealth disparity, you do have these land grabs, corrupt land grabs, and these peasants have their farms and their houses just taken from them, and they're given little or no compensation. The only group of people in Chinese society that regularly protest are farmers and rural workers. And you see it all the time. We get these little flashes that come up, news from some province, and thousands of protesters have gone crazy and burned down a police station or something like that. According to the petitioning process, they come to Beijing with whatever their grievance is. It could be talking about having a house stolen from them. It could be one of their family members has been hurt or killed. It could be just a local corruption complaint. They go to Beijing and they think, well, I'm going to put my petition into the petitioning office. But just say they come from the province of Xi'an, the local authorities don't want them going to Beijing and talking about how these local officials are corrupt. So they'll organise a bunch of local thugs to meet them at the petitioning office in Beijing. And it's very dangerous for the peasants to try and do this. And they'll just wait at the petition office. They'll get word that they're going there, the thugs will. And then as soon as these farmers turn up, they belt the crap out of them.
Today, China executed the former head of its Food and Drug Safety Agency. He was convicted of taking almost $1 million in bribes.
You see these astronomical figures of how many people are killed from the death penalty every year, and you sort of, they're numbers to you. But of course, those people all have families. And I had this bizarre experience where this boy came into my life called Jack, that was his English name, who had lost his father because of the death penalty. And I got this real insight into the ways in which shame and the death penalty work together to silence people like Jack. His father was arrested in Yunnan province for trafficking heroin from the capital there to Shanghai. Jack didn't know that his dad had been killed until his uncle called him the day after. His family wasn't notified that this was going on. By all reports, the way that it happens is that the prisoner is taken outside of the city to a designated killing field and is shot in the back of the head by one bullet, very powerful gun, so that it blows the top of his head off. The body slumps in a ditch. In some provinces, there's reports of their organs being plundered and being sold on the black market. But what's in the Chinese press about the death penalty are big, high-profile cases about former leaders of the Communist Party in various areas of the country or notable business people that have been put to death for corruption. And they publicise them because it's an example of the Chinese government fighting against corruption, which must be endemic. And so it makes me still sad. I mean, talking about it makes me really sad to think about the way that Jack's life was affected. And the account in the book is a very personal one because of that. When I was looking at the death certificate of his father in his Shanghai apartment, there was a folded up receipt there in the death certificate. And Jack said that that wasn't a myth, that his family paid for the bullet. You know, I breathed in and thought, do I ask if this is the receipt of the payment or not? And this overwhelming revulsion came over me, and I couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. Jack had been crying earlier that day, and I'd been sort of spending the whole week with him drilling through details of his father's death, and I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it.
Oh, 假如我说 angry Chinese blogger. In China, history is what the government says is history. Anything that the government doesn't like, it doesn't teach. Like what happened in Beijing in 1989.
To be my Lord, but you.
I did have a run-in, really, with somebody in Shanghai recently who was first or second time visitor and was learning the language and was really starry-eyed and had no conception of how incredibly irritating it was, because there was no nuance. Everything was, I'm a Guardian reader and this is how I look at China, and I'm a very reasonable person and I see how wonderful it is and how great it is. And you think, okay, well, that's what you see now, and then, you know, maybe a year's time you'll see that it's great in some ways and not so great in other ways, and you'll begin to see it as something that isn't quite as I think it was in a kind of Orientalism, and it was really very annoying.
I think the Western media gets it wrong by not presenting a nuanced understanding of the way that China works. And that's because a nuanced understanding comes after a very long period of time of covering something in a detailed way. And it comes with a deep affinity with the culture that we just don't have yet. That even the most talented of foreign correspondents struggle with. So how do you present China to a Western audience in 4 minutes of video, which, if you look at 4 minutes of video, when you type it out on a piece of paper, it amounts to four or five voice links that the correspondent writes and some pictures. How do you get across to an audience a huge level of complexity with a page of script? You can't. Every day I was in China, I was struck by a story, a beautiful story of just interactions with Chinese people. This area of Beijing called Hohai, which is these imperial lakes, beautiful part of Beijing, really old imperial lakes around which are beautiful weeping trees and pathways that are interconnected and roll around this lake where lovers meet and canoodle on park benches, and old men with gappy teeth play draughts or mahjong, or people are getting haircuts just next to the lake where some barber has set up a little stool and they're cutting somebody's hair. And one night, wandering along, I just sat down and watched mass ballroom take effect next to a lake. And, you know, this rather militant-looking woman with a boombox running this thing. About 100 women and men dancing in lines, in formation, in this kind of daily ritual of ballroom dancing. And this woman kind of misstepped and spun and ran into me and laughed her head off. And I laughed my head off. And she pulled me into the dancing and spun me around, and you know, a woman my own mother's age, you know, and this lovely connection that I had with her, and we danced a little and we laughed and giggled across languages.
There was one group of people having a singing lesson, maybe about 20 people, and they were really good, and there was this very funny woman teaching them. She'd obviously been a professional performer and very straight-backed and very long black shiny hair and very bossy. Then she saw me and she said in Chinese, "Oh, look, there's a foreign guest. We should sing even better because you know they can't sing as well as we can." And I said, "Well, thanks very much. You're absolutely right. I can't sing as well." So she was a bit embarrassed and everyone else thought it was really funny. And I did a bow, and so we performed for each other. But that wasn't about finding out how different we were. It was finding out, yes, we are different, but we're both very ordinary in our difference.
My landlord in Beijing was this chain smoker like most middle-aged men are, and would come in and fix the hot water and pat me on the back and look at pictures of my own dad, and I'd get an email from his son the next day thanking me for being in his father's life, and all of these really touching moments where all the stuff about China didn't matter.
Netizens recently attacked Liao Xinbo, deputy director of the Guangdong Provincial Health Bureau, for a photo posted on his blog. In the photo, Liao is inspecting a disaster-stricken area as one of his subordinates holds an umbrella over him. Many netizens say the subordinate is brown-nosing, while others contend the official is so used to preferential treatment that he cannot even hold his own umbrella. Now let's take a look at today's media spin.
I was there at a press conference. It was for an International Business Ethics Institute, which was a joint institute between a Beijing university and a foreign university. They were launching this at a very fancy French boutique restaurant out of Beijing, so quite a long way to travel there. The food was absolutely divine. You know, you've got creme brulees, mini Tuscan cheesecakes, and lovely tall glasses of champagne being handed around. There were some show bags being handed out, which anybody that's gone to a press conference, that's not unusual. There might be some finely crafted memento from an ethnic minority of some province of China. None of that was in there but an envelope. And so I opened this envelope and I look in there, and there's Chairman Mao looking back at me in triplicate. There's 300 kwai, which is about the equivalent of 50 Australian dollars. And for the average Chinese worker, that's a lot of money. So I blushed. I thought, am I the only one getting this? And I sort of looked around at the other journalists, and they were confidently fingering their envelopes, going, how much money am I getting this time? And so it became my time to interview the speakers of this conference and pick up the money and put it on the table and say, isn't it ironic that this is a business ethics institute and you're giving me money? Are you trying to bribe me? They freeze and they kind of fluster, and the Chinese guy says, no, this is a Chinese tradition. It's called Hongbao. At Spring Festival, we hand all our family envelopes as a sign of respect. And, you know, in this instance, we want to reward journalists for their efforts today. And I said, well, part of this whole endeavour is to bridge, as you say, the West and the East. What is the best of the West and what is the best of the East? And surely what is the best of the West is lack of corruption and journalistic freedom and independence. And so the Western guy basically shut down the interview.
Of course, there's the business side where people fly as close as they can to the wind. Bribery and corruption goes on everywhere in business, and it is monitored.
A commentary from Shangxi Evening News says Liao Xinbo's response to netizens' anger is worth noticing. He quoted some criticisms in a follow-up article saying that he appreciates the honest opinions. He also explained that he was so involved in his discussion that he didn't notice the umbrella and that he thinks the subordinate was doing it out of concern for his health. The commentary says it's good that Liao respects netizens' opinions, even if some used really strong words.
So I went back to China Radio International and I told some colleagues about what happened, and they were appalled at my behaviour. They said, why did you give that back? And they had been embarrassed by that. And of course, foolishly, I didn't realise that absolutely every single journalist in the room there had been in a room once upon a time where they'd taken money. And so what I was doing was highlighting this practice that nobody had talked about, that everybody knew was sort of shameful, but also didn't bring it up because they didn't want to bring shame upon themselves. And I guess to a lesser extent, they liked the money. They were paid like crap by CRI. I did a story of it. I went, got nothing to lose. So I did a story about it, and then the next day when I was listening to it go to air on the weekly business program, it was cut in half, and none of the confrontation that I'd worked so much up to, so much adrenaline, none of that was there in the broadcast. They just cut that out.
Commentary from Beijing Youth Daily says this umbrella incident shows that the public has higher expectations of officials now than 20 years ago, when nobody cared whether or not officials held their own umbrellas. People want officials to enjoy fewer privileges and pay more attention to their public images.
Comment from a reader. "Hi, I still don't know your real name." I guess that's the way you should be to hide from the authorities.
Reading the News from China featured journalist James West, whose book Beijing Blur is published by Penguin Australia. Stephanie Hemelrick-Donald, Dean of Media and Communications at RMIT, and Nicholas Jose, whose book Avenue of Eternal Peace is published by Wakefield Press. Music was by Rebuilding the Rights of Statues, Brain Failure, Kung Fu Implosion, Cold-Blooded Animal, Singer XTX, Happy Avenue, Convenience Store, AK-47, Fei Wong and Karen Mock. Thanks also to ABC's Beijing correspondent Stephen McDonald and to Elise Potucker. And we'd love to hear your comments about the program, especially if you've lived in China. Just click on Add Your Comment at this address, abc.net.au/rn/360. Reading the News from China was produced by Stephen Tilley and Nick Franklin. Our 360 documentary next week is the first in a two-part series about the aftermath of the war in Sri Lanka. We'll take you to the parts of Sri Lanka where no other media has been allowed, to hear stories of despair and courage from both sides of the conflict, and the ripples it's caused in the Sri Lankan community in Australia. That's The Five Fingers of Sri Lanka. I hope you can join me then. Before we go, don't forget to check out and contribute to Birdland, this year's collaboration between 360, Pool and You. We're asking you to think about the relationship between humans and birds. Put down your thoughts in writing or record them, and then upload them to the Pool website. Your thoughts could be included in the Birdland program broadcast later this year. For more information, just go to pool.org.au/birdland. Or follow the links from our website. And to take us up to the news, here's a bit of post-punk Beijing with PK14 and their track Behind All Ruptures. They've been described as doing for the Beijing music scene what Talking Heads did for New York in the 1970s. More information about them on the 360 website, abc.net.au/rn/360. And stay with ABC Radio National, because coming up next is Poetica.